Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang. It has been quite some time since we took off with Bhagwan to Africa, to the continent, the only overseas visit that Bhagwan has ever done. And because of the circumstances, it has been delayed by a week. But this fortnight, we will be resuming that journey, that unforgettable odyssey to the African continent, where there are so many lessons to be learned, so many beautiful incidents, so many messages that Swami delivered. And of course, as we do all this, I'm sure we will bask in His love and enjoy in tasting the divine sweetness. So to bring all our listeners up to speed, I think I'll just briefly recap what we have done so far. But before I do that, let me welcome Brother Prem, who is in the studio over here, as well as join him in together placing our humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. So let me quickly go into a flashback and see where we had reached. We had reached the 6th of July in 1968, and we spoke in particular about Dr. Kishan Gadia's experiences of how what Swami had told to him had become prophetic, how Swami visited his home on the 7th of July. So that is where we had stopped the previous time we were discussing about Bhagwan's visit to Africa. We saw how Dr. Kishan Gadia was actually held at gunpoint by a soldier and how Swami saved his life. And we also went through the thrilling details of what Swami revealed much later in 2003 or something in Trai Vrindavan. Swami revealed how that soldier also became Swami's devotee and visited Swami and had his darshan at Vrindavan. So today we will resume from the 7th of July. The 7th of July was a Sunday in 1968, and it holds special importance because this was the first ever public address that Bhagwan delivered at Kampala, the capital city of Uganda.
Right. Maybe just before that, we'd spoken about Kishan Gadia and the context that Swami had given an audience to the doctors who had gathered. Right?
Yes.
And that was on the 6th of July. And Swami was actually, that was one of the most busiest days, I think, for Swami, because the number of groups that Swami met.
Mm-hmm.
And probably, I think, when we are done with Swami's trip, we should come back to this discussion which Swami had with the doctors.
Because it
was a question and answer session, which is very beautifully documented by Professor Kasturi. And I'm sure some of those questions are very important. In fact, just a tidbit of that, one of those doctors asked Swami that, Swami, Lord Shiva is a Hindu god.
Mm-hmm.
And he's supposed to be the, you know, Maheshwara, the greatest among all gods. How did he incarnate as a Muslim as Shirdi Baba? Right? You know, such questions, and Swami very patiently answered some of them. And very firmly, you know, some of those answers that Swami gave, I think, are really worth going back to. But we'll come back to that later. But the other thing which, other group which Swami interacted with was the Rotarians. You know, wherever you go in the world, there is this Rotary Club, right? They call themselves Rotarians. You have the Lions Club, and they're called the Lions. They call themselves the Lions. So this Rotary Club was, again, it's usually a very mixed group. You have professionals, you have advocates, you'll have, businessmen and all of them.
But basically the elite.
Right, basically the elite. And invariably they'll come together and do some social activity, apart from social recreation, which they usually do.
They do some charity and...
Right, and I think one of them, you know, one of the things which was very striking there, which Swami, they asked Swami and Swami replied to them, was when they asked Swami, what is the message that we all should take with us?
Hmm.
And if there's any one message that we all have to take, and spontaneously Swami said, work is worship, duty is God. He said, that's a very, very important thing that you all should carry. And, you know, it was so beautiful because here was a mixture of people from different professions. And Swami was not telling them, all of you start doing bhajans, all of you start doing meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all looking for some spiritual guidance, literally. And Swami said, work is worship, duty is God. And that's something similar to what Swami had told even the doctors. In fact, when talking to the doctors, Swami, in the end, when they asked Swami, what is the message for all of us, Swami just said one sentence which was so very profound. And I'm sure all the doctors in our among the listeners will be able to relate to it. Swami said, live up to the oath that you've taken. That is more than enough.
The Hippocratic Oath.
The Hippocratic Oath, which the medical professionals usually take before they start their profession.
I remember a doctor who said that if all the doctors ensure that the Hippocratic Oath doesn't become a hypocritic oath, that's more than enough.
Right, exactly. And that's all Swami said. Swami said, you all have taken an oath. Live up to that oath. That's all you need to do as doctors.
Beautiful. What you said, that Swami presented spirituality in such a practical manner, that held true for all the discourses that Swami delivered in Africa. We already went through one of those discourses that Swami delivered in the capital city of Kenya, Nairobi.
Right. Right.
This public discourse on the 7th of July at Kampala, it happened at a vast space around the Patidar building. And there were about 30,000 people who had gathered there. I happened to see some of those photos, Prem, of Swami delivering this discourse. Mm-hmm. And it's a very, very, you know, basic kind of setting. There's a small dais over there, and a Sarvadharma symbol lit up with lights that is in the backdrop. That's it. And right. There's a table covered with a cloth and a chair, mm-hmm. and a standing mic stand. It looks very ordinary, and, you know, having been used to seeing the kind of diocese that Swami has adorned in Prashanti and in Vrindavan, it really feels very, very, very ordinary. But that's the speciality of the avatar, I think, because it's not the stage that makes the occasion extraordinary, it's the extraordinary being there. And even on that day, before Swami actually ascended the dais, those three steps that led to the dais, Swami walked all around, you know, quenching the thirst of those thousands for darshan.
Right, 15,000 is what Kasturi records, I think, right?
Yes, in another place, I think, you know, it's like, it starts off with 15,000, by the time it's all done, the crowd has grown.
Okay.
That's how it happens at Prashanti also. So, another place where I saw it was recorded as 30,000, so...
Mm-hmm.
But in that discourse also, Swami focused on this kind of practical spirituality. In fact, the way Swami defined God himself is amazing. Swami said, God, or any other term that you use to represent God, means only one thing, the source of all love. And what is love? Swami said, love is the source of all solutions. So therefore, for any problem you have, the solution is love. And the source of that love is God, what we call as God. So it was a very universal kind of definition, very beautiful definition. And Swami went on to say that don't get misled into thinking that security that you are seeking, peace that you are seeking, joy and happiness that you are seeking are all obtainable in the external world. They are not. They are obtainable only through God, who is the source of love. And he said that this God is omnipresent in all beings, in everyone, and therefore it is not as if you express your love and service and seva. We do so many things for God. It is not to just one idol in the altar or one being whom you consider as guru. You have to do it to everyone. And in order to highlight this, Swami said that deha, the human body, and desha, the country, are like the sheets that cover the real you. Swami said the real you is there, and there are multiple sheets. One of desha and one of deha. And Swami said, you have to upkeep the sheath because that is necessary, that is needed for you to realize the true you. And so, he said, you take care of your body so that you can be useful to society. And when you are useful to society, you will see that society is also useful to you, becomes helpful to you. So, this was a kind of connection that Swami built between the individual and society, where he said that it is a harmonious, symbiotic relationship, a mutual relationship, where each benefits the other and both grow together. You can't be selfish and think that I'll take care of myself and I want help and assistance and facilities from society, but I will care a damn for society. Because the society is built by multiple individuals, and if each individual does his duty towards the society, society also will do its duty towards the individual. That's why I think, you know, Swami said duty is God. This duty is God. And Swami, again, when he says work is worship, he doesn't recommend us to keep aside some time and do some ritual separately for God. He says, whatever work you're doing, do that itself as worship. This is such a enlightening message, because many times we often degrade worship to the level of work, you know. Worship becomes a chore for us. Worship becomes a thing that I have to do every day. Instead of that, Swami says, let the work that you do every day become an offering to the Supreme Being.
And absolutely. And, you know, the kind of things which Swami said in that discourse were very appropriate in many levels. One of the things which, as you mentioned, was unity of religion. Swami was saying that don't go by the labels, and everybody reaches the same God. And I think that was one thing which Swami was going on repeating. But the, what Swami spoke about society was very, very important, probably especially for the Indian community there. Because that was one of the problems which the later, as we saw, which led to the whole problem in Uganda of the ouster of all these Asians. Because there was not enough blending between the Indian community and the rest of the society as they saw it. And I think probably Swami is making a reference to that. You know, you have to understand that you draw from the society and you are as much bound to the society as, you know, you mean as you are bound to your body, as Swami said. Just like how you are related to your body, you as an individual is related to the society, and it's your duty to nourish the society that you have born and brought up in. You know, you might not be born yet, this might not be your native place, but the very fact that you become rich, you're a businessman or you're a doctor, your profession is prospered, it's because of the society around you. It's not necessarily your country or, you know, your native land, but the immediate society around you has given you what you have, and you have to show gratitude for that. I think Swami was very emphatic when he was making that point.
Absolutely. And another interesting thing to note is Swami did not go into any examples from the Ramayana, the Mahabharata, the Bhagavad Gita and all that. And Swami himself said this to Professor Kasturi later on, that I have purposely avoided such references because those references do not mean much to the people here. So, you know, it becomes very clear. Swami was not bent upon propagating one religion or propagating certain name or propagating certain texts. He was simply, you know, out of love, just sharing the way to true joy, peace and contentment with everyone there. That's all that Swami was doing, and therefore it didn't matter whether they followed the Ramayana or the Mahabharata, whether they followed Jesus or they followed Islam. It didn't matter. He wanted everyone to simply cultivate love. And Swami said that is the actual remedy and solution for everything. Man is ill because of many things, but he is seeking only pseudo remedies which heal the symptoms. And Swami said the way of the wise. In fact, this discourse that Swami delivered on the 7th of July is recorded in the Satya Sai Speaks with the title The Way of the Wise.
Mm-hmm.
Swami said the way of the wise is to discover the root cause and apply a remedy that solves that root cause. And Swami said, when you find out that root cause, you will understand that the only remedy is to sow the seeds of love in the soil of the heart. And when you do this, there will be some weeds that will try to, you know, crush the seed or hinder the development of the sapling. And those weeds are the Arshad Vargas, or the six negative qualities of Kama, Krodha, Lobha, Moha, Mada and Matsarya. He says, weed out these six vices and water the seed of love with the water of faith. And said, when this happens, you will get the blossoms of sahana. Sahana meaning
Forbearance.
Yes, I was getting the word tolerance. Tolerance only describes one aspect. Forbearance. Forbearance is such a positive thing. And finally result in the fruits of peace. Peace that you are all searching. So it all begins by sowing love and watering it with faith, keeping away the six vices of desire, greed, anger, lust, attachment and jealousy.
And two other points that Swami made which was very interesting is, one, Swami said, don't take life too seriously. And that is one point which Swami said. You know, he said it's like a newspaper. You know, when you read a newspaper, you glance through the headlines, you read a few news articles in detail, but still you don't get attached to the news, you know, because it's a newspaper and tomorrow it's going to be a waste.
Mm.
So Swami said, same is the case with the life. You know, don't take it too seriously that you're so attached to it, and everything that you do is guided by what you are in this in present life or things like that. Swami said, take it easy and you know, understand that you're only here to pick up lessons, just like how you just pick out some headlines and read it, and then move on. And the other point which Swami made was, as you said, you know, Swami never spoke much about the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. And even when Swami was making a reference to some of the Indian concepts, where Swami started speaking about Maya, Swami said that, you know, there is no duality, though people might appear different based on their religion. There's always oneness, but there is this illusion of duality or multiplicity. And Swami said, in the Indian context, it is called Maya. And Swami was explaining, and it's called illusion. In India, we call it Maya. And then Swami said, Maya is an enchantress, because it's so easy to fall in that trap that there is multiplicity. The fact is there is only one, but it's so easy to fall for that, that that's why Maya is an enchantress. And Swami went on to say that she will make you dance. She's a nartaki, right? An enchantress is nartaki, and the only way to come out of that grasp or to, you know, move yourself out and beyond is through kirtana, as Swami would, I think many times Swami makes this play of words.
It's so beautiful, nartaki. You know, because nartaki means dancer, and a dancer is one who makes you forget reality and get pulled into the dance, engrossed in that, and that's what Maya does. And nartaki, if you reverse it, it becomes kirtana. The way to oppose Maya is to go reverse of Maya is through kirtana. Beautiful message. Kirtana is thinking the name of God. And before making the statement, Swami said, you know, Swami was talking about people who say that there is no God. Swami says that those who question the existence of God are like children who don't know the alphabet but question the existence of literature. If you don't know A, B, C, D, how will you be able to appreciate literature? You will naturally think it doesn't exist, because for you it only seems like gibberish. So once you learn the alphabets, then only will you be able to appreciate literature. And Swami says, even those who try to learn the alphabet get stuck at only one letter instead of multiple letters. And what is that one letter? Swami said that is I. Swami said, don't get stuck at I. Learn more, realize the I. And in order, that is when Swami brought in the point of Maya. Swami said, in order to realize the I, you have to realize that everything that you associate with yourself, you are attached to, and you identify yourself with, is all illusory, what we call as Maya. And in order to give up that I and learn the other alphabet, so that you will be able to appreciate literature, or you will be able to appreciate God, is through kirtana, namasmarana, singing the glory of God.
In many ways, I think it must have been a very refreshing message for the people over there. You know, you have an Indian master who's coming. It's probably such a generic message, such a very, very, you know, when you say universal message which Swami has given. I mean, it's not like Swami had to look out for something universal and give his message. It's always universal. But from the people who are sitting in the audience, you know, as Professor Kasturi writes many times, the crowd had a larger percentage of the African people in the thing.
And you must remember, Prem, that this was that point of time in history, like many such points of time in history, when a large number of efforts were going on for conversion into various religions. Religions were competing in converting, and it was almost like, you know, putting a sales pitch in saying that this is better than that. And in such a kind of environment, here is somebody who comes and says, it doesn't matter whom you follow, what you follow, which God you follow, which religion you follow, because what matters is love. If there is love, it doesn't matter what you follow. If there is no love, again it doesn't matter what you follow, because everything is useless. So in that sense, really it would have been a big, big refresher, because here was somebody who is coming and giving a message without any hidden agenda, without any, you know, it feels like here's a person who is not a salesman, who is just come as an advisor, because that was an environment where it was all looking like different sales pitches for different religions.
That is one thing. And the other thing is, you know, discrimination based on the skin color. I mean, that was also very, very rampant.
Apartheid.
I mean, right, in the sense that this was something like lesser humanity. I mean, it was almost, that was the approach which the colonial masters had in these lands. And here Swami was saying, you know, one of the statements that Swami made is, the nationalities may be different, religions may be different, but fundamentally every individual is a jivatma who is struggling to go to the divine state. And that is like Swami saying that, you know, you may even be good or bad, you may even be a criminal, but within you is that soul which is trying to raise higher. And Swami said that is how all of you are one. I mean, that kind of a message, you know, you could be born anywhere, you could be doing anything, you could be educated, uneducated, but you are essentially doing the same thing which every human being is doing in the world. I think that's what made all of these people feel that Swami was like one amongst them, you know, more than anything else.
Absolutely. The things that Swami said were all such great equalizers. It made everyone feel equal. And I feel that is one of the, charms, or that is one of the traits of a wonderful leader, the avatar. Every leader, usually if you see, they become exclusive. They become exclusive and they are at a position where nobody can aspire to reach, everybody can only look up in admiration. But the avatar is so inclusive. In fact, the most special thing about the avatar is we feel that he is divine, while we are not. Even in that case, Swami has been so inclusive, because whenever Swami has spoken of his divinity, he has always added the statement saying that, I am divine, but so are you. It's just that I know it and you don't know it. Once you know it, in fact, you know, the other day I was speaking to Professor H.J. Bhagya, Bhagya sir, and he was saying that, Swami said, realization is so easy. It is tougher to crush a rose petal with your thumbnail. But it is easier than that to get realization. You just have to be ready. You know, when somebody speaks like this, it feels so encouraging and motivating, because whenever we have heard the terms like liberation or moksha or becoming one with God, we always feel that it's a path that is strewn with hardships and involves great sacrifices and great pains, trials, tribulations. But when Swami says the truth that it is as easy, it is just that you have to give up your self-made wrong concepts. It really encourages makes us feel one with Him. This kind of all-inclusive attitude and nature, definitely, as you said, would have been very, very, very refreshing for all the people in Kampala.
And, you know, when we say that we are devotees of Swami, I think it goes without saying that we should have that same amount of, you know, welcoming nature. I'm reminded of what some of our lecturers who were students in the Vrindavan campus, you know, in the erstwhile Arts and Science College. Some of them used to go to the Bangalore University and study and come back and stay in the hostel, right? So that was the time when Swami would give them new clothes to wear and things like that. And one of the instructions that Swami gave was so very beautiful. And I think in many, many levels, we all should try to practice that. And Swami said, you dress in such a manner that you don't look too simple that a rich man refuses to come and, you know, hesitates to come and speak to you. Don't dress in such an ostentatious manner that an ordinary illiterate man, you know, hesitates to come and ask you a question. Right? You know, when you're walking on the road, somebody is looking for an address or something, they should not feel like, hey, this guy is too elite and I can't go and ask him.
Or he's too... Right?
Or he's too ordinary or too, you know, looking too cheap, I can't go and ask him. Swami said, whenever you dress with this in mind. I mean, what a beautiful way of raising the normal day-to-day thing to, you know, something which Swami embodies. I think that's what we need to do in language, in the way we speak, in the way we interact with people. Are we always keeping this in mind? Am I welcoming the way Swami was welcoming? Because we have seen that interview room door of Swami was open for everybody. As you've said many times, you know, we've seen tribals going there. We've seen Swami calling all these, you know, village folk arts. Those people will be welcome. At the same time, it's open for the Saudi prince. It's open for the kings and queens and the prince and prime ministers and everybody. And I think we should reflect that. And that's what Swami is doing here. You know, as you're saying, the stage was so very simple. The people were so very simple. But Swami was at home there. You know, that's the beauty of Swami.
And that was what happened on the 7th of July. In fact, on the 8th of July, a Monday, that was again a memorable day for the people at Kampala, because Swami delivered a second public address there. But I think before we go into what happened on the 8th of July and the details of that memorable public address, we'll take a quick break. On the other side of the break, dear listeners, we will continue with Bhagwan Sajjan in Africa.
priyatanaya.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We're talking about Swami's Africa trip, and we spoke about the first discourse which Swami gave in Kampala, which was on the 7th of July. But the interesting thing was Swami gave another beautiful discourse on the 8th of July too, which was the very next day.
But that was in the evening.
Right. Both discourses were in the evening.
Right. So in the morning, as always, Bhagwan granted darshan, there were bhajans, there were dozens and dozens of interviews to all kinds of people, you know. That's what Kasturi Garu records of how all strata of society, all kinds of people, people from all nationalities, Indians, Africans, everybody got interviews. And there were some very prominent members also, and some of them Kasturi has noted. For instance, the Mr. Madhwani, who was heading the Madhwani Group, industrial conglomerate, he from Jinja. Jinja is a city in Uganda. Mm-hmm. From there, he came to visit Swami. And actually, you know, if you look up this Madhwani Group of companies, it's really big. In fact, it's supposed to be the largest conglomerate in Uganda, and it contributes to almost 10% of the country's GDP. Mm-hmm. So, such a big group, and a little more, if we trace their history, we'll get to know that in 1970, that is 2 years after Bhagwan's visit, they were ousted by Idi Amin from Uganda, and they were okay. all driven away. And the country took over all their businesses in Uganda, and over the next 15 years, all these companies almost ran into bankruptcy. It was in 1985 that the government of Uganda once again invited the members of this Madhwani group to come back and take over their companies in a completely devastated and nearly bankrupt state. And they took over with the help of a loan from the World Bank and again started them back, and now they're running in profit. So that is a brief history of the Madhwani group. And the head of this Mr. Madhwani, that's all Professor Kasturi records. I don't know what is the first name of this Mr. Madhwani, but Mr. Madhwani also came, and he also was blessed with an interview with Bhagwan, and he went back a very happy and wise and satisfied man. Apart from that, the Minister for Information and Broadcasting in Uganda, Mr. Ojira, he also came, and he got a long interview, and he was profusely expressing his sorrow to Swami, sorry and sorrow to Swami, saying that I was not able to come earlier because I was ill. But he was very moved, and I think because of that, Bhagwan's discourse that took place on the 8th of July, it was actually broadcast, not live, but it was recorded and broadcast to people all around Uganda on their national television.
And I think the minister also informed Swami that actually the parliament was in session, and that's why most of the ministers were not able to come and have Swami's darshan.
Though they were eager to.
Right, though they were very eager to. In fact, some of them do come a little later, but, you know, sometime in, later in the evening they come and see Swami. I think one of them, I think we'll come to that a little later. It, Swami gives them an interview as late as 8 o'clock or something like that to some of them. But that was one of the reasons why not many of them came. But in spite of that, Swami says the Minister of Defense, Professor Kasturi writes that the Minister of Defense, Onama,
Mr. Onama,
right, he had come, and he had also had the privilege of having an interview with Swami, and all of them had quite long sessions, as you know, he records.
And as we were saying, the public address was at the same venue at the Patidar Bungalow in the grounds there in the evening. And I was saying how Swami said the previous day that he didn't use any examples from Ramayana and Mahabharata because the people were not aware. In this discourse, I think Swami decided to acquaint the people with the Sanatana Samskriti, the Bharatiya culture. And so he introduces a little theme from the Ramayana as well as a little theme from the Mahabharata to all these people. But once again, the entire discourse is practical spirituality. In fact, Swami started his discourse with a very practical message and highlighted it with an example from the Ramayana. Africa is a country that abounds with nature, that has been blessed with nature's bounty in terms of the flora and fauna there. And Swami said the mistake that man is doing today is that he is seeking mastery over nature. He is seeking nature. He should not do that. Instead, he should try to seek the Lord of nature, that is God himself. And in that context, Swami gave the example of Ravana, of how one should not be. Ravana sought Sita who is considered as Prakriti or nature. Instead of seeking the Lord of Prakriti, that is, instead of seeking the Natha of Sita, which is Lord Rama, Ravana sought Sita, and that was the beginning of his downfall. So too, Swami said, one should not try to master nature. Instead, try to seek the master of nature, that is God.
Exactly. And, you know, many reasons probably why Swami chose to then start speaking about the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. You know, one of the reasons was to present the Ramayana as not a scriptural work where you look at somebody as divinity and you worship them. You know, Swami was literally giving the essence of the Ramayana, because when we did the Ramkatha, I think this was a point which we mentioned many times, because Swami does emphasize on that. It's about greed going after Prakriti and forgetting the divine aspect altogether. And Swami was saying this, I think, one, to educate the Africans, and probably to educate the Indian community too. You know, because some of these people who were settled there, they were saying that, you know, the only connection they had with the Indian culture which they had was the stories of Ramayana and Mahabharata. They would listen from their grandparents, who were probably those who lived there in a good number of years in India before they moved to Africa. So even to them, I think Swami was putting the whole story in the right context and giving it to them. And as you're saying, it was such an important message for a fledgling government, for a fledgling country which is coming up. And there's always that temptation, you know, you're in an African country which is filled with natural resources, and there's always that temptation of over-exploiting and going after increasing your GDP and wealth and, you know, losing out
at
the cost of... Because, and Africa is, as we had mentioned before, there is this nature there where they look up to everything around them as divine, as, you know, that was, of course, debunked as pagan and all of that, but that was how their culture was, you know, very, very similar to the Indian culture, where they looked at every tree and every forest and every natural resource as a source of divinity.
Exactly. The sun is considered divine, the moon is considered divine, the tree, the forest, everything is divine. And as you said, this was a message not just for the Africans, but also for the Indians. Because if you look at the Indians' connection to India, as you said, that is one aspect. That is, they were connected to India only through these stories that their grandparents or parents told them. And if you look at the Indians' connection to Africa, that was only because of economics. They had no other connection to Africa. The only connection was, this is a place that is blessing me with riches.
Right.
So let me be here. So I think Swami was also forewarning them that this is possibly a wrong attitude to have, because don't go behind Prakriti. Don't go behind this external manifest world. Seek the Lord who is possibly unmanifest or who is manifest. Seek the Lord and let nature be a side effect, you know. That is the thing. So, therefore, if you say that I want to settle in Uganda, I want to settle in Kenya, I think it was a message for the Indians to ask themselves, why do I want to settle in Kenya? If the reason is simply because I can make more money there, then there is something wrong in that. Don't pursue that. Don't say that I want to be in Kampala because I want to make more money. And this was a very, very important message, because whether we like it or not, most of us in our lives also, when we take such decisions to move, change our societies or change our countries, predominantly it is simply based on economic considerations. And that was something against which Swami spoke quite strongly.
And I think even if that is the primary motivation, you know, I think most of the people who go to greener pastures look for economic improvement in their life. But having made the move, don't, you know, keep that alone as your focus.
Restrict to that.
Right?
Huh?
Because even now, you know, reading through this message which Swami was giving, I think now the number of people who are living in Africa, in Nigeria, and, you know, we have that beautiful documentary of Seva in Africa, which Swami's devotees are doing, it's, I mean, you can't see that and not feel warm within, you know, because the amount
Absolutely.
Of work they do. So they're all people who are there for business interests, you know, some of them are some of our old students who have settled there because of their jobs and all of that. But the way they go back to the society, go back into the slums, and they do
the way they've integrated.
Yeah, integrated. And I think some of those people whom we speak to, they say that it actually takes about 200 kilometers drive to reach some of those villages. And they take, you know, just like how we do Gram Seva here, not like how we do, because they take hampers each weighing about 8 kgs and 10 kgs. and to put that all in a truck and drive into those villages, and they're not always living as one unit. You know, you have to literally pick up those things and walk into the village and give it to them at their doorstep, because Swami says you have to give it at their doorstep. I mean, it's come such a long way. You know, we might say that 68 Swami went and gave a discourse there, but I think it's a flow from all of that, that even today we see that immense presence of Swami's devotees in Africa constantly working. And I think there's that group of doctors who make a very regular visit to Africa, led by some doctors in the UK and in the Europe. I mean, that's like an ongoing thing. It's always there. I mean, it's.
I think there was this recent SciNet program also.
Right, the SciNet program.
Where there are mosquito nets. These are nets that have been treated so that mosquitoes don't enter, because mosquito-borne, vector-borne diseases like is malaria, a very great problem in Africa.
Right.
And, Swami also addressed these people's fears, because Swami was saying that fear comes only when you move away from God. Swami gave the example of the shadow and the sun. Swami says that when you walk away from the source of light, your shadow keeps growing bigger and bigger. And that is what it is. As you move away from God, your fear grows. In order to escape that, turn and just walk towards the source of light. And Swami says, when you walk towards the source of light, when you move towards God, you will see that your shadow grows smaller and smaller. In fact, Swami went on to give another beautiful interpretation of the same. Swami said, the shadow is the smallest when the sun is right above you. So Swami says that in the second interpretation, Swami says that sun or light is your intelligence or buddhi. As your intelligence ascends, as it reaches the zenith, the shadow will get completely wiped out. So therefore, Swami was exhorting everyone to evolve, to grow in their intelligence. And grow meaning not just in terms of intelligence, but also in terms of the maturity of intelligence. Grow in wisdom. And Swami said, it is in order to attain this wisdom that we chant the Gayatri Mantra, the Bhurbhuvah Swaha, which is nothing but a prayer seeking enlightenment of one's intelligence.
Right. And again, going back to, you know, why Swami is making references to the Ramayana and the Gayatri Mantra now. You know, Swami is clearly making it clear to the people there, what are these mantras meant for? It's not to appease some god or, you know, I mean, as you're saying, the Africans are also worshipping the sun as God. They are also looking up at the moon as a deity and probably
a tree as a deity.
So Swami is giving them examples such as that and saying that these are all mantras which are so generic. It's not got to do with worshipping any deity as such. And I mean, from there Swami goes on to the part which, you know, you made a reference to before. And Swami is saying, just like the Gayatri Mantra is a means of purifying your intellect, another yoga which is available is that of devotion. Then Swami speaks about the Bhakti Yoga. And here Swami makes it very clear. You know, he says, I think Swami gives a beautiful example of a police constable who goes to work, and Swami says he wears a uniform. Throughout the day he's in the uniform. The moment he comes back home, his duty is over, he, you know, changes his dress into a casual clothes. Swami said, you can't wear Bhakti like a uniform that you wear when you go to a temple, that you wear when you go to come to a gathering like this, and then take it off and, you know, do whatever you want in other times. Swami says Bhakti is a continuous state of mind. And I mean, that again is a very beautiful example, because I think in any such visit of Swami, you know, when Swami went to any place, even in India, wherever he visited, there might have been hundreds of thousands of people who came to see Swami, but not all of them remain sincere over a period of time. And Swami would give that example from the Shirdi Avatar, where, you know, not all the mango flowers become fruits. So literally like that, there might be 15, 20 to 30,000 people sitting and listening to Swami. Not all of them are literally, you know, going to graduate into that state of having Bhakti as a state of mind. So Swami is literally encouraging them and probably tantalizing them with his example and saying that how many of you are going to graduate to that level.
This is again very important, because as you said, Africa had this culture of worshipping the tree, worshipping the animals, worshipping everything. But though that is a very good thing, it is not pagan, it is not something to be mocked or something that is low. At the same time, there is a danger that one may get attached and stuck to the rituals, forgetting the spirit behind it. As right. Swami says, it's when the spirit behind the ritual is remembered that it becomes spiritual. And by injecting bhakti and introducing bhakti, Swami made it clear that these rituals, these routine rituals mean nothing. It is only when there is bhakti, and bhakti also is not just like as you said, a uniform that is donned at certain times. It has to be there always. And the reason for that, Swami said, is it is when you do it with this bhakti or this love for God, then only can you realize God. And Swami went on to explain what it means to realize God. Swami said, you realize that God is love. That is how Swami had defined it in the previous discourse. So if God is love, therefore God is not anger, God is not hatred, God is none of these negative things that we say. So Swami said, you too should go beyond all this. Then only can you say that you love God. You too should go beyond anger, beyond hatred. And Swami gives a beautiful example. Swami says, you see, why I say this example is very beautiful is because whenever I listen to Swami saying that you should love everyone, you should not have hatred, anger, it is easy to love anybody who loves me. Possibly it is possible to love someone who does nothing to me, who is neutral. But how do I love someone who harms me? Okay, how do I love someone who harms me by mistake? How do I love someone who actively plans and, you know, makes plans to harm me? How do I do that? And for that, Swami gives the example that when you're having food, if your teeth happen to bite the tongue, will you take a stone and break your teeth? You'll say, no, because it's my tongue, it's my teeth. You know, the tongue also belongs to you, the teeth also belongs to you. Whether you hurt the tongue or the teeth, I'm going to feel the hurt. So why will I double my hurt by hurting the teeth, because they bit the tongue? Swami says, that is how it is, because whether you are able to see it or not, you're not able to see it because of Maya, as Swami had spoken yesterday. But when you see reality, you'll realize that we are all part of the same being. I am God, you are God, everything around is God. And therefore, two wrongs don't make it right. Like how Mahatma Gandhi would say, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth would result in the whole world being blind and toothless. We'll have to use dentures. So, Swami said, you let this example be an inspiration for you. Just as you don't break your teeth or harm your teeth just because they bit the tongue, so too, just because someone does harm to you, don't do harm back to them. We should not hurt even those that cause pain to us, because all of us are part of the same being that we call God.
Right. And then Swami made another reference to an Indian epic, which was the Mahabharata. When speaking in this very context, he said, you know, when this nature is there, when you don't want to hurt anybody, when you start considering everybody as your own and you behave in this manner, I mean, in other words, just being that, expressing that goodness which is your natural side. Swami said, it is like you're taking the side of God instead of the side of
what is
evil and what is not your nature. And then Swami gave the example of the Pandavas and the Kauravas, where, you know, again, rephrasing this whole thing in the context of how the story has to be understood, even for the Indian community. Swami said, it's an example of a set of people who are very much related to each other. You know, they are very much coming from the same clan. But one set chooses to be by the side of God and the other chooses the wrong path, and what happens is there to be seen. And Swami very patiently describes the whole story, you know, the relevant parts to this crowd which is predominantly fresh to this entire epic. Right? So Swami explains who are the Pandavas and who are the Kauravas.
And explains that if God is on your side, the world is in your hold.
Right.
Though you might be deprived of your kingdom, though you might be humiliated, though all this might happen, all of that will not matter at all. Just like a person who has been given a painkiller doesn't feel the pain, God's grace will be like that painkiller, where you don't feel any pain and you will heal faster, you will recover faster, and you will be healthy faster, only if you choose God. And when I say recover and health, it's I'm speaking about spiritual health. And that is why Swami exhorted to everyone there that when God is so important, you should start sadhana as early as possible in life. you know, we consider career to be important, relationship to be important, and whatever we consider as important, we start working towards it as early as possible in life. If I feel wealth is important, I start saving the moment I start earning, possibly even before I start earning, when I'm receiving pocket money from my parents itself, I start saving. So you see, whatever we feel is important in our life, we start working for it early in our life, because we feel that it's no use of doing it late. When it comes to savings, people say that if you start saving at the age of 25 versus you start saving at the age of 35, the difference in your savings by the time you reach 60 is phenomenal. Just that 10-year earlier start, however small the amount of saving might be, matters a lot. And that is how they encourage. So those who wish to have a huge bank balance, try to start early in saving. That is the case in every other thing. Whatever you feel is important to you, you start early in life. And here Swami had explained the importance of God. In fact, God alone matters in life. And therefore Swami said, don't you think it is important that you start this early in life? Don't postpone all the sadhana that you want to do for advanced years. You have no idea what will happen to you. You know, because that is such a powerful statement, Prem. You know, a little digression, if I can say, you know, 10 years ago, I just felt that I can never get sick or anything, you know. I can't become, I can't get bad health, because it seemed like I'm in the pink of health, you know, and I would have no control on my eating. I would love to eat. That's one of my weaknesses. I always say that I have two weaknesses of the tongue. One is speaking, one is eating, the input and output weaknesses. And it was fine, you know, because the moment I feel that I have gained 1 or 2 kilos, all I need to do is put in some extra energy expenditure for 1 or 2 days and I'm back to normal. So I just felt that gaining weight and all is a myth. But that was because I was 25. Today I'm 35 and I see that just to burn 1 or 2 kilos, 1 or 2 days are not enough. Possibly I need 1 or 2 weeks. And now I'm thinking that how foolish was I to think that I need not take care of my health because I'm awesome. And this is already the wisdom that is dawning at 35. I'm thinking at 45, possibly I'll be more wise. And see, that is what happens. When we are young, we feel that nothing can happen to us and we have got all the time in the world we will spend. But it is only as we advance in years, we'll find out different problems that come up. And we realize how wise it is to start early in whatever is top priority for us. So while we start early in our education, in our health, in our savings, in many things, we forget to start early in the greatest goal of human life, which is divinity. And that is why Swami is saying that you may not understand why it is, not possible to do it at an advanced stage, but let me assure you, you can't do it at an advanced stage. So therefore, start sadhana right away, because it is never too early. Let it not become too late.
In fact, talking about starting early, there was a forward which we received some time back about booking a kindergarten seat when the child is just born. In fact, in some places, it's even before the child is born. I mean, 2011, if the child is born and the bookings for 4 years later into a school is already booked.
Oh my God, I was not aware of this.
I mean, it's a regular thing in the cities, in the metropolitan cities, it happens. The moment you give birth to a child, you go and book a seat for 3 or 4 years later when you will put the child in the school. Okay. And sometimes people are late. They say that, you know, you should have come probably a month before itself. You know, admissions are closed for this year. I mean, that's how desperate we are to start early. And talking about, in fact, when Swami was talking to who would be the first few office bearers of the organization in Africa, and that discussion comes later, Swami said this, you know, you have to spread this idea of worshipping God as early as possible. And Swami knew that, you know, it is the age of the Kali and agnostics are going to increase. The number of people who are going to question faith and question the existence of God are going to increase. And you need people who will talk about divinity and talk about spirituality with conviction. And Swami said that is the role all of you have to play. And I think in one of these discourses also Swami mentions that, you know, let this be the seeds that have been sown and nourish it. And so that even others can benefit around you, not merely you who have come and, you know, just seen Swami and gone away.
The highlight of this discourse, according to me, of course, we have to, whenever we say highlight of the discourse with regard to Swami's discourse, we have to stay according to us or according to whom, because depending on our level of evolution, something appears like a highlight. So for me, what I felt was the highlight of this discourse was Swami gave a detailed explanation on how one should go about doing Jyoti meditation. This is so beautiful because Jyoti meditation is universal. It is not linked to any deity, it's not linked to any form of God, it's not linked to any religion, it's not linked to any cult, it's not linked to anything. It is so universal in its practice and so universal in its benefit. And it is amazing. For me, this is the first time that I'm coming across such a detailed explanation of how one should do Jyoti meditation. In fact, this discourse has been recorded in the Satya Sai Speaks under the heading Light the Lamps of Love. This discourse on the 8th of July 1968. But I think, Prem, before we go into the details of how Swami said one should do Jyoti meditation, we'll take another quick break. Dear listeners, on the other side of the break, we will go into the details of how Swami enthused the people in Kampala to take up Jyoti meditation.
దయకు ప్రేమకు రూపు దాల్చిన దైవమా సాయి దైవమా దిక్కులేని దీన జనుల బ్రోవ వచ్చిన దైవమా నా దైవమా సాయి దైవమా నా దైవమా సాయి దైవమా దయకు ప్రేమకు రూపు దాల్చిన దైవమా సాయి దైవమా కరువై గుండె బరువై దిక్కు తోచక దరిని చేరే ప్రేమ కరువై గుండె బరువై దిక్కు తోచక దరిని చేరే కల్లివై మరి తండ్రివై ప్రేమ చూపిన దైవమా నా దైవమా సాయి దైవమా నా దైవమా సాయి దైవమా గయకు ప్రేమకు రూపు దాల్చిన దైవమా సాయి దైవమా పతిత పావన పాపనాశక సత్యలోకవాసి సాయి దైవమా కరుణ చిలికి కైవల్యమొసగే సాయి రూపా దైవమా నా దైవమా సాయి దైవమా నా దైవమా సాయి దైవమా దయకు ప్రేమకు రూపు దాల్చిన దైవమా సాయి దైవమా దిక్కులేని దీన జనుల బ్రోవవతి నా దైవమా నా దైవమా సాయి దైవమా నా దైవమా సాయి దైవమా దయకు ప్రేమకు రూపు దాల్చిన దైవమా సాయి దైవమా.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were talking about the discourse which Swami gave on 8th of July 1968 in Kampala, the second discourse which Swami gave. And we were talking about what Swami said. One of the very important things that Swami said in the course of that discourse was Swami explained to that crowd how Jyoti meditation is to be done. Swami said that meditation is a very useful tool when you want to clean your conscience. That's what Swami said, when you want to progress towards divinity, this is a very important tool. As we said, Swami spoke about the Gayatri Mantra, then Swami spoke about devotion, and in the later part of the discourse, Swami speaks about meditation. And that's when Swami speaks, not just mentions Jyoti meditation, but very, very beautifully describes the whole process to the gathering there.
See, this is amazing because Swami is speaking about all the three ways, you know, devotion, work, as well as meditation. So it is not like Swami stresses that only do bhajans or only meditate or only do service. It's not like that. Swami is encouraging all the three, because I feel it is one speciality among Swami's teachings where he doesn't stick to one. It's like Swami says that if only the head grows, it's not a healthy body. It's lopsided development. All three. Karma, that is service, then devotion, and wisdom, meditation and other such things are all three wheels of a three-wheel vehicle. You cannot move the vehicle with one of the wheels missing. Of course, based on your preference and choice, you can select one of them to be your front wheel, but make sure that you have got the other two as the back wheels. If I think that I'm a bhajan singer and I feel devotion is my way to reach God, that can be my front wheel, definitely, but I definitely must have meditation and study of Swami's literature, as well as service and working for Swami as the other two wheels behind. Otherwise, my vehicle is going to crash. And so Swami began speaking about Jyoti meditation. In fact, rather than speak about it, I think it's best to read directly that paragraph from the Satya Sai Speaks. Swami says, set aside a few minutes every day in the beginning for this. Later you are sure to extend the period when you experience the thrill of peace in the morning. Swami says a few minutes in the morning. Later on you can extend it because you will be enjoying the peace. Let it be the hours before dawn. This is preferable because the body is refreshed by sleep and the peregrinations of the daytime have yet to impinge on the senses and distract physical and mental energy. We notice this happens when we wake up early in the morning. We are so fresh because our thought process has not yet begun. Usually I notice that after I get up, within 5 minutes, what do I do? What has happened today? Yesterday's news? What is the work I have to do at studio today? All that come and start bombarding within 2-3 minutes of getting up. But those 2-3 minutes as soon as I get up is very pure and pristine, and I'm in a state that is indescribable. It's a state of having almost no thoughts. But within 2 minutes, why 2 minutes? Sometimes within 30 seconds, you know, the minute the thoughts start bombarding and you remember everything actually. You know, oh, last night this happened, yesterday was this, oh, today I have to see what is this, what happened, what was the news that I was following, what is the work, all that coming. So Swami is saying, start this Jyoti meditation at that point time in the day when you are very fresh, when you are refreshed and your senses have not yet started their assault on your mind.
And then Swami goes on to explain the whole process. He says, have a lamp with a bright little flame, steady and straight, or a candle before you. The flame does not diminish in luster, however many lamps may be lit therefrom. So the flame is the most appropriate symbol of the eternal absolute. So Swami is explaining why this idea of meditating on a flame. See, many times Swami would say this, you know, even when you do japam, you take a name and you do japam on that, but at some point you'll have to think of what that name represents too, the qualities that the name represents. Because that's when that purity starts, percolating into your heart. So Swami is saying, what is the nature of the lamp? Why are you taking the lamp? You know, it's not about an oil lamp or anything else. But the idea of that flame is that it's infinite. You know, it can give and it does not diminish by itself. And you know, that is the nature of the lamp, which is a representation of divinity itself. Right? And then Swami goes on to say, sit in the Padmasana or the lotus posture or any comfortable asana in front of the flame. Look on the flame steadily and closing your eyes, try to feel it inside you, between your eyebrows. From there, let it descend down into the lotus of your heart, illuminating the path. When it enters the heart in the center of the chest, imagine that the petals of the lotus bud open out one by one, bathing every thought, feeling, emotion and impulse in the light and removing darkness.
Swami then goes on to say, there is no space now for darkness to take refuge in you. It has to flee before the flame. Imagine that the light becomes wider, bigger, brighter. It pervades the limbs. They can no more busy themselves in dark, wicked, suspicious activities. They have become, you are conscious of it, instruments of light, that is to say, of love. The light reaches the tongue. Falsehood, slander, bragging, spite, all of these vanish from it. It reaches the eyes and the ears. All dark desires that infest and infect them are destroyed by the brilliant light of wisdom and virtue. No more puerility, no more poisoning of the ear. Let your head be charged with that light. All wicked and vicious thoughts disappear, for these are denizens of darkness. Imagine that light in you more and more intensely, and it will be so. Let it shine all around you, enveloping you in the brilliance of love. Let it spread from you in ever-widening circles, taking into its fold your kith and kin, the loved ones, friends, companions, and later, strangers, foes, rivals, enemies, all men all over the world, all living beings, all creation. Now, this is what Swami would often refer to as expansion love. Your love should grow, it should expand. That is why Swami sings in the song which Swami himself has said defines who he is. Love is my form, truth is my breath, bliss is my food. In that he says, my life is my message, expansion is my life. And here Swami is exhorting each and every one of us to make expansion our life also.
Right, and this is precisely the, you know, light meditation or jyoti meditation. Of course, the Balvika students and the SSC students are very well aware of this, but, you know, it's not just about concentrating on the light, or it's not just about focusing your mind and removing the unnecessary thoughts. Swami is saying that even as you think of all this, you know, the beautiful way in which Swami says, when it goes to the heart, what are you supposed to visualize? You know, what are the things which are driven out of the heart when you visualize this light in your heart? When you visualize the same illumination in your limbs, what are the things that you're supposed to visualize? When you visualize this lamp entering your, you know, organs of the sense organs, what are the kind of things you're supposed to visualize? And I think this is the beautiful way, and it's probably the only type of meditation which Swami has himself spoken of and has suggested. Because, you know, all the other, there are so many different types of yogas. Swami does not speak much of them, but this is one type of meditation which Swami has spoken of so much, right?
Swami goes on to say, keep doing this over and over again, and you will reach a point where you no longer relish the darkness. One might get a kind of a doubt here, you know, as to, if I just imagine light, mm-hmm. will I really drive out darkness? You know, I'm just imagining that a falsehood is going out of me. Will it really go out of me? But we think we are imagining. What we don't realize is the truth. Swami says, I am divine and so are you. When I am imagining, it is actually the will of the Lord. That is what I don't remember. That is what I often forget. And that is why, you know, there is that saying that whether you think you are God or whether you think you are a dog, you are right. You are right. Because what you think you become. And in the Bible, I think it is captured as dust you think, dust you are, God you think, God you are. So That is why we have so many people or so many books, so many presentations, so many documentaries emphasizing on being optimist, having positive thinking over negative thinking. You know, I also remember some examples. One, there is our Indian bowler in cricket. He's currently the coach of the Indian national team, Anil Kumble.
Mm-hmm.
He, in an interview, said that every night when I sleep during a match, if I have got a match to play the next day and I am sleeping, I always, as I go to sleep, visualize the opposing batsman. And I bowl to him 100 deliveries at night. And I bowl and bowl and bowl and I know his weakness. And that is how I am able to successfully bowl to him the next day in the match. And you know, when I say Anil Kumble, he is one of India's most successful spinners, a successful spin bowler. So it's not like it is somebody speaking. It's a person who has got a huge amount of success backing him, who is speaking on the importance of visualization. I also read, you know, the story in the popular series of books called Chicken Soup for the Soul. I forget the name of this golfer, but this golfer was written off because the most productive and important years of his playing life were spent in a concentration camp during the World War II. And he was holed up in a small cage and there was nothing he could do. And yet when he came out, he became one of the star golfers. He might not have made it to number one spot, but he was in the top 10. And when he was asked later as to how is it that he honed his skills, though he had not touched a golf club for years, he said that when I was locked up in that small cage, I had nothing to do. I could not do whatever. It was dark, and instead of dying in boredom and due to lack of activity, I would play golf daily for hours on the end. And imagine, he has been putting it or teeing off shots in his imagination, what we call as imagination. But you realize that it is not imagination, because a dozen years later, when he's out of that concentration camp, he's one of the top golfers in the world. So what we think as imagination is not so imaginary. It is very real, because in that way, when we look at our fears, they're imaginary only, but they become real, right? Fear of darkness, fear of ghosts, they're all imaginary, but they become so real for us because our imagination, we should realize, is God's will, because whether we believe it or not, we are all inherently divine.
And you know, talking of this Jyoti meditation, tempted to narrate that incident of an old student who tried that Jyoti meditation. I mean, it's a very famous story in the hostel, and I'm sure many listeners also might know about this. You know, apparently one of the students, when he had joined Swami's college, I mean, this is a mistake which we do. You know, we think that to go closer to Swami or to be dearer to Swami, we need to do something special, right? Some special technique of spirituality is needed. So he was one of those people who thought that now we are in God's presence and we need to master some Kundalini yoga or something like, some Hatha yoga or something. So he was looking for something to start, right? And that's when apparently Swami gave a discourse on Jyoti meditation to all the students. So he started practicing Jyoti meditation, and he would go to this, in Vrindavan we have that second hostel, right? We used to call it the old hostel. So he would go there. It was a abandoned, I mean, it was not used during the day, during the year, unless Swami comes there. So apparently he would go there and he would do this Jyoti meditation. He would light a candle, and he found that he could never find that flame being stable, because one of the things which Swami said in that discourse was
steady,
you know,
flame.
Let the flame be steady. So what he would do, he would take the cardboard of a notebook, right? You know, the after you remove all the pages, you have the cardboard.
The outer cover.
Right? So he would take that and make a V shape around the the candle, and he would meditate on the flame. So he did that for almost a month, right? One thing which Swami told in that discourse was, you know, with practice, you will find that illumination you can feel that illumination within you. Even as you're meditating, you will feel that warmth and illumination within you. So he was keenly looking out for that experience, right? So he was doing this, and apparently one day when he was doing the meditation, he, you know, alas, found that warmth and illumination within. So he could feel that warmth, and it was growing and growing, and he thought, my God, I'm having a brilliant experience now. And when he opened his eyes, he found that the candle had dipped, the cardboard had caught fire and whatever was around it had caught fire, and actually there was a huge flame in front of him, and that was what was causing the warmth. So he said, you know, that's it. That was the last day I did it. I got really, you know, disillusioned, and he found no more inspiration to continue that, right? So he was saying that very evening or the next day or something like that, Swami comes up to him and Swami says, "Hey, you fool, you don't know how to do meditation. That's why it's happened like this." And then Swami gave a beautiful discourse on Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, where he was saying that Dhyana, Dharana and Samadhi are the last three. And he said there are five stages before that. And what are the first two stages? It is Yama and Niyama, which is discipline, which is normally, you know, doing the good things, speaking softly to others, not speaking lies, not harming others. Swami said, this is the basis. If you don't set the foundation right, how can you have the building standing? And that is a mistake which most of you people do.
We directly go to dhyana, right, by forgetting the first five.
We directly want the samadhi. We don't want to, you know, go by the ashram disciplines or the hostel disciplines or whatever it is.
I'm sure our listeners' curiosity is piqued. So just to quickly go through that, it is yama, niyama, pranayama,
pratyahara, asana,
dhyana,
dharana,
samadhi. So what are these five, if we can quickly define them? So yama is?
Yama and niyama are personal, disciplines, and discipline in a society.
Okay.
So yama is discipline in the society, where I think we had discussed about it in one of our satsangs. Satya, asteya, aparigraha,
not stealing, not coveting.
Right.
Not coveting others.
So those are disciplines which you follow in the society, in the community. And then niyama are disciplines which you set for yourself, where, you know, Swami talks about cleanliness, about
saucha,
and all of that, which whether you're in a crowd or you're by yourself, you follow it.
Then we go to pranayama, which is
breath control.
I feel this pranayama, breath control, apart from you doing it for a few hours in a day, it is so important, because if we examine our own day, there are many times in the day when our breath goes out of control, either because of highs or because of lows. Either we are depressed or we are excited. It is impossible to keep our breath moderated when we are excited and depressed. So,
exactly.
In fact, if you have to have breath control, you have to have equanimity.
Right. In fact, you know, one of the doctors who spoke about the yoga practice, she made a very beautiful point. He said, you know, in poetry, we always say that's a breathtaking sight, right? That sight of nature took my breath away.
Yes.
Which means when you're in moments which are very, very good, or very, very close to divinity, actually your breath is becoming very, very light. So he says the more you you spend your time in that state of mind.
Light breathing.
Right. You automatically do what is pranayama supposed to do for you. And that is what, as you're saying, keep away from anger, keep away from all
keep
of
away
these
from the highs
emotions,
and the lows.
Right, emotions, yes, which actually make you breathe faster.
So pranayama, though it physically manifests as holding the nostrils in a way and breathing some way, it actually refers to having equanimity. You know, which means that until and unless I develop equanimity, I am not yet ready for dharana, dhyana and samadhi.
Exactly.
So I mean, a lot of preparation has to go before I actually take a flame and start doing it. Then after pranayama, we go to asana.
Asana, right. Asana is, of course, the physical exercises and
the
all of that.
Posture and...
I mean, that again...
Flexibility.
That again, we do it because we don't have any other form of exercise. Because earlier, asana was nothing but doing the duties which you're supposed to do. You know, physical duties which you're supposed to do, be it a householder or be it a wife or be it a, you know, student, whatever physical activity you're supposed to do, not running away from that and doing it sincerely. You know, that itself will form an asana, actually.
You won't believe this, Prem. You know, two years ago, one of my cousins who is in Germany, when he came to me, he told that, you know, you're doing something. When he looked at my house, he said, there's one mistake in your house. What is it? He said, see, you are having two bathrooms in your house and both of them have the Western style of toilet. So I said, so what's wrong? He said, no. And he showed me some videos and some research which says that the best way to void your bowels is by using a toilet in the Indian style.
Right.
And he said, therefore, You know, in our home, we have got one in the Indian style, and even in the Western style, he shows one kind of a low stool that is placed on which you have to keep your legs so that your posture almost becomes like you're in an Indian style toilet. And he was saying, this is the way, you know, you're supposed to do, and therefore we are now having technology, we are having these kind of props and supports that help us do that. I was just thinking that, you know, 30 years back, this is what we were doing actually, but we shifted into what we thought as convenient, right. And now therefore, I have to take this up as an added, as an added accessory in the bathroom. So, similar to that, when we say asana, it is not, yogasana is not an exercise that I do in some part of the day. This is the way we have to supposed to do things. This is the way I'm supposed to walk. This is the way I'm supposed to eat. This is the way I'm supposed to sit. That is what is different asanas. This is the way I'm supposed to relax. This is the way I'm supposed to stretch my back. Because we have not been following it and we have been taking up things that give temporary comfort, we have lost all this and we are now taking up yogasanas as a kind of an exercise and a kind of rigor that we have to do for a certain time in the day. I feel that is an important mindset change that we have to realize and go back to living our way in this life, because the Bharatiya kind of life is actually a way of life. Swami would say Bharatiya culture is just a way of life. It's not any religion or any rigid system.
Right. And I mean, in summary, you can just say that asana is anything that you do to keep your body in good health. You know, it's very clear. Swami says you can't reach samadhi or concentration or meditation, any of that, if you're going to have 100 ailments in your body. And that's why all of that, and that's why the next one also becomes very important. Swami says pratyahara is keeping a watch on everything that enters your body. You know, be it food, be it the habits which you have.
The air.
The company which you keep, the kind of things that you see, the kind of things that you listen, the kind of things that you think. To have control of all that which enters your system is only what is called pratyahara. So Swami says that asana, pranayama, pratyahara, it's all of that which keeps the body in good health. And all of this is required if you want to go to dharana, dhyana and samadhi, which is concentration, meditation and thoughtless state or samadhi.
See Prem, I know that we had not planned speaking about Patanjali's 8 steps in yoga, and I'm 100% sure that we have actually done an entire satsang on this, but still let me confess that this is something that I needed to hear today. I definitely need to hear, because even though we had done a satsang on this, I had forgotten some parts of it, and even there are those parts that I remember, I definitely feel they need me to practice them, because it has been such a revelation for me. And these are the moments when we get thrilled, because we realize that though we think we are preparing and doing a satsang, it is He who is pulling the strings and it is He who is helping us, because it is not that we are doing a satsang which benefits our listeners. It is a satsang where all of us who are part of the satsang is benefited solely because of Swami. And I'm grateful to Swami for this experience.
That's the beauty. I think even this very discourse, as you were talking about this discourse, you said the standout point is the light meditation. Probably 1 year later when we come back to the same discourse, I'm sure something else will call our attention and say that, you know, this is the most beautiful part of the discourse. And that is why, as Swami had said in the previous African Odyssey satsang which we had, Swami makes that statement, I am the Sanatana but come as Nutana. He said every time you look at Swami, he always looks new. Every time you read his discourses, it's going to appear new, because I think we have a very, very long way to go. So there is enough for us to find in this, you know, mine of Swami's wisdom and words.
And in fact, Swami concluded his discourse along these lines only. He said, therefore, do your sadhana regularly. Don't do it only when a Mahatma comes. You know, I think it's obvious reference to himself there, saying that only when some special person comes, or in the modern context, we have a retreat once in a year, or maybe once in a season, or once in a quarter, or we have some big program, we have some festival. Let that not be the only time when we come together for sadhana. That is possibly a time when we take our sadhana to a next level, but sadhana has to be done regularly. Swami, in fact, concludes his discourse there by saying that sadhana should be done like how you do your duty in life. It is one of your duties, the most important duty, in fact. So that is how Swami concluded his discourse, singing a bhajan, Namasmarana bhajan, which everyone joined in heartily. And, I know that it's almost 2 o'clock and our time slot is over, but just to conclude this one day, that is the 8th of July, Uganda Television broadcasted this discourse later on and also broadcast the interviews with many ministers and other important government people who met Swami, you know. So these people who are important for the country, they were speaking of their experience with Swami, how positive it had been, how elevating, how uplifting it had been, and Uganda Television broadcasted all these positive reviews which were filled with hope for mankind. And Kasturi Garu records that after his discourse, when Swami came back, he saw for some time all these programs on the Uganda Television, and later in the night a short film on African wildlife was shown to Bhagwan, and Swami watched that also. That was how the 8th of July came to an end. And we now move towards the 9th and 10th of July, which are very important because the 10th of July is Guru Purnima, but I think that will have to wait for our satsang next week, and we will be stopping at the 8th of July.
So dear listeners, thank you for joining us, and we most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. Do join us again next week for the continuation of the African Odyssey. We're going to leave you with a song sung by African devotees, South African devotees to be more precise. On the other side of it, you'll be joined by Chandu for the next segment of the day, Love to Love.
I'm done for Charlie.